Today on the show, we're going to be talking about the path to FI in the high cost of living area of LA. This story includes the fully funded lifestyle change, the game show path to FI, the solo 401k entrepreneurship, and Waffles on Wednesday. Welcome to the ultimate crowdsourced personal finance show.
You're listening to Choose FI Radio. The blueprint for financial independence lives here. If you're looking to unlock the secrets to financial independence and early retirement, you're in the right place. Stay tuned and join a community of like-minded people who are getting off the hamster wheel and taking control of their lives in the pursuit of financial independence. Choose FI, your home for financial independence online.
So today on the show, we are bringing on Mr. and Mrs. Waffles on Wednesday, which may be either it's competing for the best name in the FI space or the second best right behind Slowly Sipping Coffee. We're going to explore that and we're going to get a chance to talk about the secret behind reaching financial independence, and that is getting on a game show. This episode is going to be absolutely fabulous. And to help me with this, I have my co-host Brad here with me today. How you doing, buddy?
Hey, Jonathan, I'm doing well. Well, you certainly set up some intriguing lines of conversation that I'm curious about. Waffles on Wednesday, where does that come from? Game show path to FI. So we got some really, really interesting topics. And with that, I'm pleased to welcome Mr. and Mrs. Wow.
Thanks for having us. With an entrance like that, I mean, Slowly Sipping Coffee, I'm glad to be in that company.
Well, we haven't gotten Mrs. Slowly Sipping Coffee on. She's been ducking us, but we got Mrs. Waffles on Wednesday, so we're correcting that mistake right now.
Hey, guys. Good to be here. Hey. I'm here too, I guess.
You're going to help us on this journey. But to be fair, you are the game show winner. Like, tell us about that.
A couple years ago, my company went on a company outing. And we went to The Price is Right, which they give free tickets. And so we did it as a company outing. And I ended up on stage. I ended up guessing the price of a 3D television exactly. So I won that. And then I won $500 cash for winning the prize, guessing the price directly on the nose. And then I got up and got selected to play the spelling bee, where I won a measuring cup. For guessing the price of a measuring cup. And then
fancy here.
And then basically the way it worked is when you got two cards, and then when you guessed the price of three things, which I guessed the price of a toaster wrong, and I guessed the price of scissors wrong, but I did get the measuring cup right. So I got an extra card. They offered me $1,000 for each of the three cards, and I said no, and the first one had a C on it. And then I said no, and the second one had an A on it. And then I said no, and the third one said car. It was one of the two cards that had car written in full. So I ended up winning a Toyota Corolla.
Wow. This is incredible. I mean, this is it. This is what we have been waiting for this entire time. So from there on out, what do you do with this newfound success?
Oh, so it was pretty funny, right? So you have 90 days until they air it, and then you have 90 days until they send you all the prizes. I should rewind a little bit. A lot of the people listening to this will probably be interested. When you win, they sit you in the front row, and then they take you backstage at the end, and they say, here's your prizes. You have 10 days to deny them or claim them. I'd call an accountant, and then they push you out the door. So I went and claimed the car. I tried to sell it on Craigslist, but everybody wanted to lowball me because it was a car that I won. I went to the dealership. They deal with it all the time. I took possession of a brand new car, drove it down to Jamba Juice and put 1 mile on it and took it right back to him and sold it to him as a used car and walked out with a check for $15,000.
So the retail price would have been about $19,000?
Well, come learn that the following January when I got a 1099 from CBS for $21,000, which was the total of all the prizes. And that comes on a 1099 with no withholdings and it goes against your income for the following year.
So I just want to work through the economics because we can't help ourselves. Because at our core, we are always going to be, you know, at some level a finance show. Like, yeah. Is this thing, so you just got $15,000 and all is well and good? Or is there more to this story?
There's a lot more, actually, because I got a 1099 in January of the following year. And then that went on my income tax. And so I had to pay my full graduated income tax rate against the full MSRP of all the prizes that I won. me in my ignorance just put $15,000 in the box as opposed to the full 1099 value. So I got a nasty gram from the IRS about 9 months later saying that I owed them another $4,000, I think it was, for the difference. So I actually went into the local IRS office here in Los Angeles and went in with, I forget the exact section of the tax code, but it says that if you win something that's not cash, you are only responsible for the market value of the prize that you won. And so I walked in there with the receipt for $15,000 and I said, this is the market value because this is what I sold it for on the open market. And so I ended up winning that fight with the IRS and they backed off.
You actually went into the IRS building?
Yeah, it was the most miserable place, probably next to the Social Security office.
So hold on, I want to ask a question about that. Why did you go into the IRS office as opposed to just writing a response letter like 99% of other people do?
Oh, I did write a response letter and they wanted me to come in and verify it.
Really?
So I wrote them a letter. I think I actually have a copy of it on the article that you guys are referencing. And I just said, hey, there's this section in the tax code. I followed this section in the tax code. And they said, okay, we need you to come in and discuss this. So I said, all right, fine. And so I went in and it was funny because I was sitting there in the cube and the guy looked at me and was like, what's going on? And so I explained it to him and it's like section 1672C or something. I have to look it up. And I said, well, this says, you know, you're only responsible for the market value of the prize that you win. And he goes, oh, okay. Can you keep it down? Because I don't want my boss to know that I don't know this. And so, so I said, is that it? Will I ever hear from you again about this? And he says, no, I'll clear it up right now.
I just went ahead and Googled that tax code section for the listeners. It's 1.74-1A2. So I hope that's helpful for you.
You're faster than me. I'm trying to find it right now.
I have a question, actually. Did you find that tax code section after the fact, after you put down the $15,000, or had you done research? Most normal people, you get a 1099, you put that into your taxable income. Did you just say, oh, no, I really received $15,000? Or did you research this and realize, oh, I really should be putting $15,000?
I did some searching around and understood that you should pay for the $15,000. Like I said, I found that. I found some other blogs that mentioned it because it's kind of an odd situation to put yourself in. And so I searched around and I found some things and I found the tax code. But, you know, being that I'm not an accountant, I didn't know how to fully account for it properly on my 1040. And so, yeah, I just threw the $15,000 in the box for the 1099. And then the government said, wait a minute, these don't match. And in hindsight, I should have matched them and then put an addendum on it that reduced it to the market rate. And I think that's what the IRS guy did to adjust my taxes for that year.
I'm imagining like this alternate universe where Brad Barrett is the one sitting in the front row of Price is Right as an accountant, knowing how things need to be lined up. And he gets picked to come to the front and play the game. And he's like, nah, man, I'm good. I don't want to do it.
Well, it's funny because every time we watch a game show now, they did a mega Price is Right where some lady won a Ferrari. And I'm just like, oh, good luck with that. Because that poor lady's going to add $175,000 of income to her taxes for the year with no withholdings from it.
So let's play that out. So this is all based on the fact that you actually sold the car and you actually brought home $15,000 of cash. What isn't represented by this is if you had decided to keep, in your case, the Corolla, in this exaggerated case, the Ferrari. Like, how much would your Corolla have actually cost you, this free car have actually cost you if you had decided to keep it?
Well, so in order to take possession of it, you pay the sales tax and the registration. So in California, that's 10% sales tax. And the registration is, I think, another 3 or 4% on top of that. So I ended up paying $2,500 to take possession of the car. And then you pay your full graduated income tax rate on the MSRP. So I would have paid, again, in California, we have about call it for round numbers, 10% income tax rate. And then we have, you know, a 25% federal tax rate, whatever happens to be your graduated income tax rate. And so, yeah, I would have paid, so 35% of 20,000. So that's 7,000 plus $2,500 for the sales tax and registration. So it would have been about a $9,000 car.
Wow, totally free. Great.
Totally free. Completely win. Yeah. It's pretty funny because I got that argument a lot from people. Well, it's a free car.
Yeah, my favorite part of the story is whenever we bring it up to people, they're like, oh man, that's so cool. Tell me more about it. And then I get the like eye roll from Mr. Wow of like, oh, here we go again. Let me tell you all about the lack of benefits of winning a free car.
Yeah, I mean, I think this speaks to winning non-cash prizes, right? I see this on HGTV. They have their whatever they call it, dream home or some such. And I mean, it's almost 100% certainty that those people have to sell the home because obviously all of that income goes on their tax return as taxable income. And in order to pay that huge tax bomb, where are they going to come up with the money? So it sounds great in theory, but unfortunately, you have to pay taxes on income, right?
Yeah. And one of the things that kind of caught me by surprise that I wasn't aware of is with game shows in California, they're not required to provide a cash alternative, which is what I would have taken. But you either decline the prizes or you take them and there is no cash alternative.
So Mr. Wow, just one other thing came up, the accountant's brain in me, I have to ask this. So you said there was that additional amount when you got that big notice from the IRS, it sounded like they were hitting you with some kind of interest and penalty as well, just doing the back of the envelope math, that couldn't possibly be just the income tax. Did they try to hit you with interest and penalty as well?
Yeah, they tried to charge me that $4,000. They hit us with the additional income tax. And then there were penalties and fees on top of that since it was delayed and since I filed it wrong.
Okay. And because we're all about actionable tips here, just one thing I want to pass along to the audience is when you see a penalty on some type of IRS notice that they send you, that's usually something that you can actually get abated or knocked down to zero. What I've seen in my experience is now, obviously, in this case, you were in the right and it got the entirety of it got knocked down to zero. But let's say like you just underpaid your tax and it was legitimate, but they were trying to hit you with interest and penalty as well. Well, you have to pay your tax and you have to pay your interest. But in general terms, you can send a letter to the IRS just basically saying, hey, look, I've been a really solid taxpayer. Of course, you're going to come up with better words than this, but
I have the better words, Brad. I actually had this. I had a $200 penalty for just like, I guess, underpaying it over the course of the last year as I transitioned from being a W-2 employee to, for the first time, I guess, an entrepreneur, right? That's a pretty big transition there. And I actually was assessed a penalty. I can read the letter that I wrote to the IRS. It has great words.
We love great words.
All right. So this is what I wrote to the IRS. And Laura helped me with this, so that's why they're great words. I don't want to take credit for this. I am writing in response to your letter dated May 7th. In this letter, the IRS assessed a $257 estimated tax penalty for my 2017 tax return. I would like to request abatement of the $257 estimated tax penalty. 2017 was my first year being self-employed, and I was unsure of exactly how to calculate my estimated tax liability. You can see that for 2018, I am paying quarterly estimated tax payments so that I will have 100% of my 2017 tax liability paid, the safe harbor provision. I had no intention of not paying the tax that I owed. You can see that I have always paid my tax liability in full and on time, and I assure you this issue will not arise again now that I understand the estimated tax rules. Thank you for your time and understanding, and I look forward to your response. Laura helped me with that, and those are fantastic words. I highly encourage that you replicate that.
So that's fantastic. That's very legalese.
I just wanted to say wow.
That's a good word. We're gonna use a lot. Wow. So this was obviously, you know, a great hook and a fun tangent. And honestly, thanks to kind of Brad weighing on this, it was very actionable as well. I hope our audience gets value from it. Not because necessarily they're going to be as good as you are at game shows, Mr. Wow, but just because generally weird stuff happens with the tax code and you need to understand, you know, the better ground game you have, the more options you have. But I think really we need to get back to your individual story. And I want to talk about the fact that your blog is called Waffles on Wednesday, which does not include the word personal finance anywhere in there. Let's go straight to the heart of this origin story. Why did you decide to document the journey and how did you guys find financial independence? Mrs. Wow, let's bring you in on this.
All right. Well, We basically started the blog because we got sick of talking just to each other about financial independence. And, you know, some of the things that have happened in our life and our story, like going on The Price is Right, have been interesting. And we thought people might actually get some value out of it and some other actionable tips and all of that. And so we came up with the concept to start the blog. And then, of course, you know, we had to come up with a name. And we sat there for a while, a couple weeks, maybe into a couple months, and we had no idea what we were going to do for the name. And then one morning, it happened to be on a weekend. I think it was actually a Sunday when it happened. We were sitting having breakfast. We weren't having waffles that morning. I think we were having like pancakes or French toast or something like that. The two of us were sitting there and we just kind of realized those breakfasts that we had on the morning were pivotal to our life right there. We were able to kind of slow it down, just chit chat about the week, chit chat about life goals, kind of where we were going. That just kind of spearheaded its way into this mantra that we kind of came up with of, why does this only have to be on the weekends? Why can't we make this any day during the week? Lo and behold, the waffles on Wednesday with the wow kind of just popped into our head. And we were like, that's it right there. That's what we're working towards, having that flexibility, having the options and the freedom to be able to do what we want when we want.
Brad, I'm wondering if this resonates with you, because in my mind, like the high picture of this is like, once you are on this path to financial independence, and really long before you even reach it, every day becomes Saturday, right?
Yeah. Why does it just have to be the weekend? That's a really, really insightful point about just your entire life. Why didn't we just have to live for the weekends? So that's fantastic. I'm curious, where were you in your FI journey at this point? Like when you decided to start a blog, when you're sitting there having this conversation, what does it look like? How far along the path were you?
Well, I think I'd start by saying that Mr. Wow was actually the one that had been in this mindset for a while, probably a couple years, and had been trying to get me on board for a while. And it took me a little bit, but once I finally got hooked, I was on all the way. And, you know, the two of us kind of took it and ran with it. So we started the blog a little over a year and a half ago, and we're pretty close. We were within a couple years at that point. So definitely towards the end-ish of the journey.
Okay. So you said something in there. It took me a little bit, but once we were on board, we took it and ran with it. So talk me through, like, it took me a little bit. What does that look like in your life?
It looked like maybe 6 months, maybe even closer to a year on my end. Mr. Wow would send me some emails of some blog posts and be like, hey, you should really check this out. Maybe look at this book. And at that point, I don't really know what it was. I didn't have the interest. You know, I'm not in the tech, the software, you know, I'm not in the numbers brain, I guess you could say. So I think that's one reason that it just really took me a while to kind of grasp it and really start to understand what was going on. The big thing that happened is Mr. Wow, he knew how to get me by bringing in travel. Travel is a huge thing that I love to do. And right now, having the typical jobs, we're limited because we have to be back for our jobs. And he knew that by saying, hey, if we get to five, if we get to financial independence, we will be able to travel as long as we want. From that moment on, that really was my why of FI right there. Yep. Okay. I have a goal and this is where I want to go from there.
That's fascinating that for you, travel was the hook. We've kind of landed on that same thing as well, that the messaging of this stuff is incredibly important. And I think for a while, in many people's eyes, and still to some degree in the mainstream, this path to financial independence seems to just be about everything that you can't do, all the things that you're giving up, the extreme frugality, you know, and whether or not that is fair, that does seem to be the norm in terms of what this looks like from the outside. And I know that at least in Brad and my eyes and your eyes, and I think a lot of the people in our community, it's so much more than that. I mean, right, Mr. Wow, this for you is all the things that we can't do because we're stuck in the hamster wheel.
Yeah, it's one of those things that it took me a little while to get on board with, you know, because I actually found the FI movement, if you'll call it, through looking for investment advice. I had come across a decent amount of money as a bonus from work And I ended up handing it off to an investment advisor that I had had for years that ran my Roth IRA and some other things that I had had, you know, here and there. And I just never put any mind to it. And then when the market started taking off in 2012, 2013, I went back and looked at the returns that he was giving me and versus the market. And I said, wait a minute, the market's up like 35%. You're returning like 5%. And you're charging me 1% on top of this? Like, what is going on? This doesn't make any sense. And of course, you know, my personality says, well, I can do this myself better. And so that's when I started researching it. And I came across actually Jim Collins' blog first, which is actually, it's kind of a funny segue into FI because I was looking for investment advice and I came across that. And that's kind of my entrance to the rabbit hole of this whole financial independence thing, was actually trying to find investment advice. And then once I started going further down the rabbit hole, I realized, wait a minute, we're not extravagant, but we could be smarter, and we're actually set up pretty well. And looking at some of these other blogs, we could actually make this happen. And so as I started reading more and more, I was like, no, we really can make this happen. and so that's when I started trying to convince her and send things over, and she just ignored me for a good while until I finally figured out, you know, if I could hook her with the travel thing, and then she would start paying attention.
So actually, I want to follow up about that specifically. We're constantly asked, how do you get your spouse on board? People are always asking us that, like, hey, I dove into FI, this sounds amazing, but I can't convince my significant other. I mean, as Mrs. Wow described it, it took her about 6 months of you maybe introducing this for her to get into it. Do you recollect your thought process of when you had that aha moment of, hey, let's go with the travel? That's the messaging that might work. It's not going to be the numbers, but it's got to be this, I don't know, softer side, if you will. Like, do you remember your thought process?
Well, we had always talked about taking time off and traveling the world. You know, it's one of those pipe dream things that is never going to come real and all this. And so we had talked about that ever since we started dating. And then as I started going down this, you know, this path and became more educated on it, I realized that that would be something that we could actually make a reality. And we kind of did, in a way. We spent 6 weeks backpacking Europe for a honeymoon. And I think it was right after that that you kind of became full on board, because having experienced it a little bit and then having to come back and go to work, we came back. And I think that's when it finally sunk in with her that if we actually make this financial thing happen, that could be our life. And I think just that experience alone is what kind of solidified it. And I think that's what really happened. Going back to your original question, it was piggybacking on something that we had always had in a pipe dream. And I think every couple has that, right? They always have this vision of what would our life be like? And if we could only do these things, this is what it would be. Well, the beautiful part about FI is it can probably make at least most of that vision happen.
So what changes in your life? So you guys have this conversation, you're on board, right? FI makes sense for us. What tangible actually changes in the next couple of weeks, next couple of months? Do you remember what legitimate and concrete changes you made immediately thereafter?
I think the big thing was really trying to figure out where our money was going and what we were spending it on, then honing in on, was that important or was that not important to us? And so kind of the big things, and I know you guys have talked about it on the show before, but it's the same for us. It was cutting our phone bill, getting rid of cable. So we actually ended up decreasing our rent. We moved from one location to another, which made our rent go down. And then we were actually able to chat with the landlord and get it to go down again. So we've had it go down two or three times now since we had the mind shift.
Once you guys got on the same path together, what implications did that have for like the trajectory of your working careers? I mean, is that one of these, okay, we're going to start pursuing financial independence, we both have good jobs, and we're on a 10-year path to FI? Or do you hit any sort of fork in the road and move in a different direction?
So we both had full-time jobs at that point. And Mrs. Wow had gotten a call from a friend about doing some side work for the company that the friend had worked at. And so she started doing some consulting. And as the months progressed and more I read and the more she started taking on consulting work, we realized that it would be a good opportunity for her to kind of start off and branch off into her own thing because the potential was a lot higher. As we started learning the ways and what was actually going on through the consulting, we realized that there was a lot more potential for her to start a company. We decided that it would be best for her to go ahead and take the risk while I had a stable income. And so it happened about 3 years ago when you started that. And it started out slow and we
almost four years.
And so it started out slow, but we took a calculated risk to let her go ahead and take more control of her professional life and to actually have more potential for her income while I had the safety net of a W-2 job.
Yeah. And I think kind of at the time for me, it was more that I wanted to do things my own way. And, you know, I thought maybe I could do it better than some of the other companies that I was working for, or just different. And because of that, I actually found that all these other opportunities kind of opened up by taking the risk, by making that jump. And, you know, now all of a sudden I have more flexibility and more freedom to really kind of tackle the things that I want to do in my professional life, but also my personal life as well.
Looking back at this now, at this decision, I'd say probably, you know, 4 years in, especially if it's work, the survivor bias makes it seem like this was the obvious choice. But if you were going to go back to that inflection point, to that decision, that kind of quote unquote risky decision, do you feel like the solid financial ground game tied to maybe the frugality bent that you had made it a much easier and more obvious choice?
Completely. Yeah. I think that gave us the comfort in order to make that jump. But the other thing was, we also had this realization of our life at that moment. It was good. You know, it wasn't a great life, but it was comfortable and we were happy. We always knew that if this failed, I could go back to exactly what I was doing at that moment, you know, full-time job, doing some consulting, anything like that. And we just go on with our lives. So having that financial support really was kind of one of the springboards to allow that decision to happen.
You guys are talking about building this business and having significant upside. Now, just from like an entrepreneurial standpoint, is this just the same like trading time for dollars, or are you building a company that has employees and that you can scale? What are we actually talking about here?
It kind of just started, you know, it was just me. It was trading time for dollars and all of that. So it still had that kind of traditional outlook to it. But the further that we kind of go on our path to FI, and the more that we realize that we have this freedom and kind of opportunity to tailor this business, to progress this business, definitely within the last maybe year, couple years, we've been trying to kind of set up some steps to progress it. So I have hired my first employee, and there's potential for more. And we're also looking at other avenues to make it a little bit more scalable.
I'll add in that one of the things that she did from the beginning that was really smart is she set it up so that there wasn't a very high fixed overhead cost. And so during her contracting, she was working for a bunch of companies that had storefronts and had, you know, all this overhead of management and things of that nature. Well, she decided to not open, in her case, a clinic and be able to keep all of that overhead cost down. And so pretty much everything on her company is a variable cost that we can control. And so that actually was a huge benefit because it upped her income quite substantially because we were no longer paying rent. We were no longer paying all this overhead for administration fees and things like that.
That's actually really timely because I wanted to ask about the ancillary benefits of owning a business that you guys may have seen, not limited necessarily to money, but wherever you can go with that. But also on the money side, are there items that you found that you can deduct like on your business and on your tax return that also then add to the financial benefit?
Yeah. So there's several things. So one of the first things I did was set up a solo 401k for her company. And so we started deducting part of her income. We also, all of the internet, all our phone bills, a lot of our traveling. We this year have gone to Cambodia and we've gone to South Africa that were both related to the business. She went to Honduras and Salt Lake. And we also have a home office. So we're writing off about a third of our rent. There's a bunch of benefits to owning the company The main one that we really like is the fact that she's now in control of her schedule. I know I still have a W-2 income, and so I am not. But her having the flexibility is really, I think, the kicker in having and owning her own company and just being able to have that flexibility and have the control of her life and be able to work when she wants and work on what she wants and be able to expand it in the way that she wants and not kind of have to take direction from anybody.
So I think this is really where I want to spend a lot of our time. It's one of the reasons that I was incredibly excited to have you both on the show, in that you are DIY entrepreneurs, which I guess, wow, that's kind of like putting both together. Entrepreneur is like by definition a DIYer. But the reason this is so appealing is that we started this conversation talking about how Mr. Wow was willing to dig into the IRS tax code and then go to the IRS to teach the IRS about their own code, you know, and in the context of starting your own business, a question that we see all the time as people that are pursuing financial independence are increasingly looking to start some sort of side hustle and growing that into a business is, what about retirement planning? And Mr. Wow has done his research and, for your specific situation, has come up with a plan that's working both for you as a couple, but also as it grows for your employee and down the road, maybe employee. So I thought we should take, you know, a large section of the remainder of the show and dive into that, because I think that is what is going to be so actionable for our audience today. So tell us about how you decided to go with solo 401k. I know there's several different retirement vehicles that are available. What made you go with solo 401k? And let's pull out any actionable content related to that we can.
When I was looking into it, there's three retirement plans for small businesses. One is called a simple IRA, one is called a SEP IRA, and then obviously the solo 401k. I decided to go with the solo 401k for a couple reasons. Number one, the SEP IRA, it's capped at $12,500 for employee contributions, and the employer is required to match 3%, which isn't a big deal, but since we're going to match anyway, but you're required to do that for every employee going forward. And this allows you to have employees. The SEP IRA is capped at 25% of your income. And that has the same higher level cap as a 401k, which I think is $18,500 now. And then the solo 401k is a little bit more complicated, but it has the cap of a traditional 401k, which is, again, I think is $18,500 for 2018. But you can also match 25% of the salary that's paid in. The caveat is that a solo 401k is only available to an owner and a spouse. And so I decided to go with that, since it was just Mrs. Wow and myself that were going to be employees at the start. The other part about that is since the $18,500 of a solo 401k is an individual contribution and the 25% match is the company contribution, you can cap it out at the $55,000 at a lot lower income level than you can on a SEP IRA, simply because you can take that $18,500 out of the income and then you add 25% of the remainder. So you can actually cap out at $55,000 at, I think, $160,000, where you have to, if you hit $55,000 on a SEP IRA, I think you have to make $220,000. So you can cap it out a lot sooner than you could through an IRA. One other thing that we did with the 401k is the SEP IRA and the simple IRA also count as traditional IRA contributions. So that would eliminate our way of doing a backdoor Roth contribution, a traditional backdoor Roth contribution. And since those go into the traditional IRA bucket, you now are enacting the pro rata rule every time you do a Roth conversion.
So I want to slow down here and actually get Brad's input on this. There's so much there, and have a feeling people are going to press that back 30 second button on this particular part of the episode to go back and listen to it. Brad, what additional thoughts do you have on this? Because I know you are kind of going through the same decision tree, looking at those different vehicles. I think you landed on the solo 401k being a better option initially as well. Was it for the same reasons he listed?
Yes, it definitely was. So yeah, the 401k plan generally seemed to be the best option for my own businesses. So like you said, the simple IRA, that just seemed like the least attractive option. So that was thrown out almost instantly. So basically, just to take a step back, there are the total limitations of $55,000 into your retirement plans, let's say, for 2018. All right. So like Mr. Rao is saying, with the SEP IRA, the only calculation is that it's just 25% of your total net business income. All right. So if you made 100 grand, you can put 25% of that into your SEP IRA. So 25,000, that's it. And then just for simplicity's sake, let's talk about the 401k in that same $100,000 net income scenario for your business. So you have the employee side, okay? So that's the crucial part. You have that 18,500, which is the employee side, as if you were an employee at a W-2 job. You can put that in, that 18,500, but then on top of it, you also get to put in 25% for the employer's side. It's usually called profit sharing. Some people call it a match, but I've seen profit sharing generally. So in that scenario, you're putting in what, 43,500, right? Because the 18,500 on the employee side and the 25,000 on the employer side. Now, there are some calculations that go into this. I've found that it's not generally as simple as just taking 25%. It usually winds up being somewhere in the vicinity of 20 or 21%, but that's beyond the scope of this conversation, certainly. But just real high level, you can put more money into the 401k option. So I think that's why Mr. and Mrs. Webb picked that. And that's why I picked it for my businesses.
But I'm curious, as a follow-up, you know, going to the more simple level, and this is like the space that I occupy, controlling your tax rate, being able to put in close to $50,000 of pre-tax income on somewhere in between $160,000 and $200,000 of income. That is an incredibly powerful tool for the entrepreneur.
I fully agree. I mean, that's exactly why we went that way. I will say, I mean, you do end up paying a little bit of payroll tax because that's a self-employment tax and that's just part of owning a company, but it's considerably less than your standard income tax. And so you come out way ahead. If you're making $300,000, $400,000, $500,000 in your business, I don't know how much difference it really makes between a SEP and a solo 401k. But given that we can cap it out and contribute considerably more at lower income levels, you know, up to $100,000, you can almost double the contributions to a solo 401k than you can a SEP. That's why we decided to go that way, especially at the beginning.
First of all, guys, thank you so much for being willing to go into this level of detail. I mean, this is an episode that we've been wanting to put it together, but we don't like to just throw information out there. We like to have a story behind it. And this story is awesome. I'm really enjoying it. Let's go a little bit deeper here because you have a business. You did all this research because it was helping you as business owners. But as your business did what hopefully everybody's business does, it grew. You have now brought on an employee and that changes the dynamic. Tell us about that.
So now that we have an employee, we're no longer eligible for a solo 401k because that's restricted to the owner and a spouse of the owner. And so we had to set up what I affectionately call a big boy 401k for a real corporation, which is like any other corporation that you have in the country. It's a 401k that we set up through a third party administrator. I called a third party administrator so that they could take care of all the filing, the paper filing and setting up the plan documentation and all the rest of it. The solo 401k is a lot easier to set up because it's just straight off the shelf. But with this new corporate 401k, the big boy 401k, we can now execute the mega backdoor Roth. And so I was curious to see what exactly was entailed with that. Since we had ownership of the plan, we could write into the bylaws anything we wanted. So I made a point to write into the bylaws that we could contribute after-tax money and that we could do non-hardship rollovers at any point. And so those are written into the bylaws. And that is really the key in what allows the mega backdoor Roth to be available to employees. Now, there's a lot of other caveats that come along with that, namely compliance testing, which I was not aware of until we actually started walking through this. And safe harbor plans are a whole nother one, which means that you are not required to fulfill the compliance testing, and which we can get into in more detail if you want. But basically, as soon as you contribute after-tax money, you have to go through the compliance testing, whether or not you meet the safe harbor requirements or not. And so what that actually does is cause some issues with the contribution limits for high income employees, or what they call highly compensated employees, which make over $120,000 a year or own more than 5% of the business. And since we own 100% of the business, we are a highly compensated employee, and our employee is not a highly compensated employee. So we're subject to this compliance testing.
Okay. So for most people who are just solo entrepreneurs, or they own a business with a business partner or some such and don't have true employees, they don't have to worry about that testing. Is that right?
No, not in a solo 401k, at least as far as I know. And again, I'm not an accountant or a retirement benefits specialist or anything of that nature. But from the research I've seen, a solo 401k, simply because it's restricted to the ownership, the owner and a spouse, that is why you don't have to do any of this compliance testing, because there is no other eligible employees.
Okay. And just to take a step back for the audience, so mega backdoor Roth, just explain what the real benefits of that are. And the two real essential buzzwords were after-tax contributions and what I've seen called in-service distributions. I think you had a different hardship, some terminology like that, but those are the terms that I've seen. Like, if you could just give like a real high-level explanation, I think that would be very, very helpful.
Yeah, sure. So everybody kind of knows, at least in this community, your contribution limit is 18.5. And your company can match 25% of your salary. So say your company pays you $20,000. You can put 18.5 of that in, and then they can match 25%. So that's $5,000. So you can put in $23,500 into the account given that scenario. Now, if you have additional money, your total is $55,000. So that discrepancy between the $23,500 and the $55,000 is this open window. And when you say allowing after-tax contributions, that means that I can actually write a check and put it into my 401k that I've already paid tax on. That's all money right out of our checking account, and put it into the 401k. And that in-service, or what I was calling a non-hardship rollover, or non-hardship withdrawal rather, allows you to roll it over into your Roth IRA, since it's after-tax money. And so you can actually take that balance and roll it directly and immediately over. And so a lot of the major corporate 401ks don't allow this for a variety of reasons, but it's not standard in the plan bylaws.
So, right, this might not be standard for most normal plans or most normal people, frankly, but for the FI community, we're always looking for these actionable tips. And this is a really great one, because you can potentially put in tens of thousands of dollars into a Roth IRA. That's pretty remarkable. I mean, this is money that is basically just sitting there that you would normally just have in your taxable investments. And through the wonders of the tax code, you're able to basically put this into a Roth IRA. That's really amazing. It grows tax-free forever and can be withdrawn tax-free. So this is a huge thing. This is not just like one of those minor little items. For entrepreneurs out there, you really should go back and listen to this like five times, because it's crucial information. So thank you, Mr. Rao.
Yeah, of course. I will say that it's not available through a lot of things. This is the only time I've ever had this available to me through my entire career. And it's simply because I manage the plan and spent about an hour and a half talking to our plan administrator and how to write the bylaws in this really complicated manner. But it's something that, if it is available to you, might be worth taking advantage of. And it's worth the question, I think, at your corporate job, if you're there. They probably will shy away from it for the compliance testing reasons, but that's okay. It's worth the question. And if it's available, it's definitely worth taking advantage of.
So for the individual that, we talked about plan administrator, and you said only in this unique situation, what was it like for you to actually find a plan administrator that would let you set this up? What should an individual do that's looking to kind of replicate this? I mean, you said this was an hour and a half of conversation. For the individual that's trying to cut through the noise and get a better answer, where do they start with this?
So where I started, I knew I had to set up a big boy 401k. So the first place I called was Vanguard. They're actually surprisingly expensive to set up a 401k, especially for a plan, with three participants. And so I called them. I called Fidelity, who actually doesn't service plans this small. They pass you off to a third-party administrator. And then I called Schwab. And Schwab also passed me off to a third-party administrator, but they were nice enough to send over a list of folks. And so that's who we went with. they were considerably cheaper to set up the plan and for the administration than Vanguard. And they offer what are in essence the exact same funds. And so we went that route. So yeah, so I run our payroll every month and then I upload a file into their interface. And then that pays out just directly like it would for any other company. Through the process of setting up the account, you know, we had a phone call with them and our administrator to write all the bylaws into the account. And they have a boilerplate set of bylaws. But of course, knowing me, I did my research and I went into it and started asking them all these super complicated questions about how we cram all this after-tax money into our 401k. And so, yeah, it turned from a 20-minute phone call into about a 90-minute phone call, at the end of which is pretty funny. They offered to send me a guy. They offered to send a guy out to tell us the benefits of a 401k plan, which I kind of laughed about.
So I want to like hop in here because this sounds awesome and it sounds crazy complicated. And like you can tell, Mr. Wow, that you are a huge DIYer. And frankly, you're probably willing to do much more research than even I am. But I'm curious with like the scale and the scope of what we're talking about. Do you do all of your taxes yourself at this point or do you use an accountant?
No, we use an accountant. Between putting together the corporate taxes because of the laws in California, we can't have an LLC. We have to have an S corp. So we actually have to file like official corporate taxes and then putting together the K-1 from the ownership of the corporation and then filing that against our personal. And then with all this 401k plan administration, yeah, I don't have the time, at least right now. Now, fast forward and we're at FI and this thing is still running and it's, you know, and then I have the time, then yeah. But right now there's just other things I would rather do with my time and my day than figure out how to put all this together. I know enough to be dangerous is the way I like to put it.
So Mrs. Wow, we talked obviously about the nuts and bolts benefits of owning a business and going out on your own. But I'm curious about your real world, like, wow, these are the personal benefits I've received. Like, do I have more time? Do I have more flexibility? What have you really noticed that has made like a dramatic difference in your life in a positive manner in the last 4 years?
So I think you mentioned a couple big things right there. The time thing, I'd love to say that I have more time, but I actually think I have less time because I have kind of come up with all these other things that I want to be doing. Reading all these blogs and, you know, chatting with people and hearing their stories, the opportunity, or I should say opportunities, has really kind of presented itself. And I find myself just wanting to go in so many different directions. So I'd have to say I definitely have less time right now. But the big thing is that flexibility piece and really being able to design my life how I want it to be. And whether that is the way that I move the company and me professionally, or whether it's something that I'm doing personally on the side. One of the big things, as we kind of mentioned before, was travel. And we've been fortunate enough in the past couple of years to be able to do a lot of travel. But in my eyes, I still want to do more. And every trip that we go on and every time that we are on the road, I just want to keep going. I definitely want to be able to do more volunteer work. And that's something that I'm super passionate about and really kind of get established with some more organizations and go to other places in the world that I haven't been yet. That's a really big thing that kind of having my company and the kind of the sideness of the company allows me to do.
So what does that volunteer work look like? How does someone get involved in international volunteer work? Do you need certain qualifications? Are they looking for anybody? Could I volunteer internationally in one of these organizations you are? Or like I said, do I need certain qualifications?
So Mrs. Wow's in healthcare. And so we ended up traveling with some health missions and she does a lot of stuff with that. But to directly answer your question, I actually go along and carry boxes and help things. There's always needs for, you know, logistics people and grunt work and things of that nature to help, and even crowd control. Oh, when we were in Cambodia, I did a lot of crowd control and providing lunches and carrying boxes and things like that. So if you're interested in doing anything like that, you can find them. They're around. You can just search for them online and find them.
Well, you're volunteering your time. I'm curious, like, for the individual that's thinking this, that has is at maybe financial independence, but maybe let's say they are in like a lean FI kind of mentality where they just have enough to cover their expenditures, but they don't have extra amounts to buy these really kind of more expensive type trips. What is the anticipated cost for this? Are you having to purchase your own plane tickets and travel? Do you have to get there? Do you have to cover your lodging? Or is it, we need all hands on deck, we just need a body? What are the economics of that choice?
Yeah, I think that's a really valuable question. And it's one that I get a lot. How do you get involved? How much does it cost? All of that kind of stuff. And really, the biggest thing I can say is just do your research. There are a lot of organizations out there that cost an arm and a leg to go volunteer your time. And they ask for thousands of dollars in fundraising in order for you to go do this. Plus, on top of that, paying your way and everything else. I try to shy away from those. I'm already volunteering my time. I'm giving up the potential work at home, you know, where I could be making money. So from a money standpoint, I'm already missing out on chunks, right, with this whole FI mindset. And so I try to find organizations that pretty much I'm just paying my way to be there. We're looking at paying for your flight. You're looking at paying lodging and food, and then anything else that you end up doing, whether there's any sort of transportation needs or souvenirs or anything else that you might be buying outside of what they provide with the group.
So when you're out there on these volunteer trips, are you then going out and exploring after the fact and going on like your own vacation? Or do you look at these as kind of individual, discrete volunteer trips?
For the most part, we are trying to do some sort of other travel kind of tacked on top of that. Outside of the Cambodia trip that we did, typically I'll go down and volunteer, you know, for a week or two, and then Mr. Wow will come down, meet me, and we will go somewhere else. I did some volunteer work in Peru last year. I was there for a week. He came down and met me, and then we went and did Machu Picchu. Same thing when we were in Ecuador. I did my volunteer work. He came down. We went to the Galapagos. Usually there's some component of a little bit of personal exploration as well as the volunteer work and that professional side. And so we really try to utilize that we're already over there. You know, we've already paid for the flight over there and we have the time at that moment to do it. So most of the time, I'd say that's how we operate.
You know, and the FI piece of this is that you're moving to a place where you own your time. That time is not obligated to some other entity. You're basically doing what we've called in the past, and we got this from Vincent Puglisi, the Red X month. We've carved this out. We've designed the future that we want to have now, and then we build the other pieces around that. And that's very attractive to me. I think our audience finds that very compelling as well. It's not necessarily about, you know, spending nothing or getting all of your expenses down to zero as much as it is about having control over your decisions and not just being totally susceptible to the latest ad that was on TV.
That's exactly right. I will say that through this volunteer work, and it's interesting because she volunteers and she does the same exact thing at home. And when we do finally pull the plug, she's probably going to continue to do it, which I think is one of those things that everybody's jealous of, that I would do what I do every day for free if I had to. But this allows us to travel. It allows her to continue her passion. I'll tell you what, I know I said I was a layman earlier, but that trip was life-changing. And I know I wasn't directly treating people or anything, but I was exposed to it and we were making a difference and it was really life-changing.
And I think the cool part about, you know, outside of just the volunteer work that I'm doing and providing medical services and really helping populations that are underserved and in need, most of the places that I'm going to volunteer at are not the top tourist destinations. Sometimes they're not even mentioned, you know, if you're trying to do some research of like things to see and where to go. You're not even going to find anything there. These are smaller little towns, little villages, and you really get a kind of different take on the local life. And you really kind of get embedded in their community. And it's something that's really unique that if you're just a tourist traveling around, going and seeing the wonders of the world and you know, checking all the boxes on Instagram of what you want to show your friends, you're not going to be seeing these places. And so I've really just gotten this unique value by going to these really just awesome and cool places that a lot of people haven't even heard of before.
That's amazing. I wanted to ask kind of about your travel bucket list in the future, but how has that experience informed your future travel plans? What do those travel plans look like? Obviously, this is a huge part of your guys' lives in the future. What do you think that looks like?
I definitely have some of my, you know, top three, top five places that I still want to go. But I also think, and this kind of just ties back into starting the company and having options, is just kind of letting it unfold as it happens. So my first volunteer trip, I was in Ecuador, and then I ended up getting connected to a group in Peru. And then when I was in Peru, all of a sudden, all these other opportunities happened. That's where I first heard about Cambodia. That's where I heard about my trip that I went to in Honduras. I think we can kind of plan a little bit and have maybe some bullet points of what we actually, where we want to go and some things that we, you know, want to be able to accomplish in our life. But then also just kind of allowing the rest of it up to chance and see what happens, you know, in the next couple months or the next couple years, and seeing maybe, you know, I'll meet somebody that's affiliated with an organization in Nepal. That's one of my top places that I want to go. You know, if I can somehow finagle that I can do some volunteer work, but then also go to a country that I'm really eager to go explore, I think that's the best of both worlds right there.
So do you picture this being full time for you? Like once you reach FI, do you guys plan to travel and leave your home base in California and just travel full time?
Yeah, I that's at least at this point, that's the plan. You know, things change. And as you can tell, we kind of take life as it comes and live with the day and make the best decision with the information and options we have at the time. But yeah, that's kind of the plan, and we'll see where it goes.
This has been fantastic. I think this has been eye-opening on multiple levels. I mean, this show covered the gamut. I mean, really, the breadth of this conversation is just fun to be a part of. Now, normally, you know, on most shows, that would be the end of the episode. But on this show, we would love to give you the chance to tackle the hot seat. Are you ready for this?
We are.
I'm so excited.
In a world drowning in debt and rampant consumption, trapped by the chains of lifestyle inflation, these questions highlight the secrets of those who have broken free. Welcome to the Choose FI Hot Seat.
All right, Mrs. Wow, question number one, your favorite blog that's not your own?
My favorite blog right now is My Son's Father. Not only does he write amazing and fantastic content, but he is also a wonder with his Lego characters.
Oh, My Son's Father. And I think it was My Son's Father and I Dream of Fire. I think, Brad, they included you in their Christmas music video 2017.
Oh, that was the greatest thing I've ever seen. Wow.
Oh, yeah. So it's cool. Fantastic.
Nice. So was that Lego thing beyond just that one video, or was that it?
Oh, no. That's all the pictures in his posts are mainly Lego characters. And he has come up with some just fantastic representations of people and animals and all that kind of stuff. So it's really unique and interesting and entertaining.
I wonder what Mr. Money Mustache looks like.
I think he's on there.
Mr. Wow, what about you? Favorite blog of all time?
I have one that's not FI and one that is FI related. My FI related one is Freedom is Groovy. I love them. And I love the talking trash episodes that they do. It's just fantastic to listen to him wander around and babble. And my non-FI related one is called The Art of Manliness. It's just kind of a general, you know, how to be a good man, right? How to be a good husband. It gets into a little bit of finance stuff, but it's how to, you know, workouts and how to dress and things like that. And it's very thought provoking. And it's just kind of one of those things that I like to go and read and kind of internalize.
Well, question number two is kind of related to this. And we'll go back to you for this one, Mr. Wow, your favorite article of all time. Now, this can be one that you wrote or somebody else's.
So my favorite article of all time is one that I think actually sent to Mrs. Wow. And it was one of the ones that kind of got her reading some of these blogs. And it's actually on The Happy Philosopher. And it's about how he ran a half marathon without training and was just in immense pain the whole time. And I think I literally sent her the email I found and I said, hey, check out this idiot. He's just like us.
And we mean that in the nice way.
Yeah, and I actually talked to him about that at FinCon. And so he actually thought that was really funny because we run a lot of long distance races and we can empathize with that. And I think that was one of the ones that kind of got her attention that, wow, you know, it's not all about money all the time.
Super funny story on that, kind of related. So I was running maybe like 3 to 4 miles a day through the course of a summer, and somebody in pharmacy school invited me to go on a run. She was training for a marathon, and we ran 17 miles before I could walk for 5 days. Yeah. Worst experience ever.
Oh, yeah, that's rough. And to have him just go out and do it without training at all and then write about the experience was just, it was kind of funny and hilarious. And we could definitely relate to it. And so, yeah, that was my favorite.
And meanwhile, you know, as we're training for a race and I can barely like run 2 miles and I'm just like, oh, gosh, how am I going to get there? And I read this post. And I'm like, this is awesome.
That is very cool. Mrs. Wow, same question. Favorite article of all time?
All right. So I'm actually going to stick with The Happy Philosopher as well. And I guess maybe it's because that's one of the first ones that I started reading. But I absolutely love his post about alligators and kittens and the implications that it has on life and time and kind of the quality of life and getting rid of the things that stress you out and before adding just all these good things to your life is just huge. And I think it's a timeless piece.
I completely agree. We've had so many of these amazing guests throughout the 100 plus episodes, and we've added certain pieces of terminology to the lexicon of Choose If I, and alligators and kittens definitely fits that bill. I think it's really important for people to look for those alligators in their lives and just get rid of them. You know, we talked in the episode with Jeff that get rid of cable news, get rid of all these things that are just bombarding you with negative messaging and just be happier.
Yeah, I think that's why it resonates so much with us, is because, again, it's about money, but the money is kind of a subtle background. It's really about, you know, happiness and freedom and being at ease with your life.
And I think so many people are so inclined to just add in, well, oh, I need more time for myself. So I need to go get a massage, or I need to go do this, or I need that, and I need that, without really tackling the bigger issues of what is potentially causing some of the detriment, you know, the stress and the lack of sleep and, you know, maybe having a bad diet, anything like that. And so it's just one of those pieces of advice that really kind of can hit on every aspect of life.
All right. Well, that leads us to question number 3. Mrs. Wow, your favorite life hack?
So this is kind of a new one for me. And I actually didn't think that this would be my answer. But over the past couple of weeks, I really have grown to have a love-hate relationship with it, but more of a love, I guess I would say. And that life hack is waking up early. I have heard a lot of people talk about this over the past couple of years, just waking up before you typically would wake up. And I used to be one of those people that it was 6 o'clock. If you woke me up before 6 o'clock, I was not a happy camper. And I ended up meeting and then, you know, having the luxury of reading 5 a.m. Joel's brand new blog. And he was really the inspiration to get me to start introducing this into my life. One of the big things is that I just don't have enough time, you know, and I think I speak to everybody here where there's so many things that we want to do and just not enough time and specifically not enough me time. He wrote a post and it basically was like, if you wake up an hour early, use that time as me time in the morning. I've started doing that and it has had such a huge impact in my life just in the month that I've been doing it in.
Do you have a particular morning routine, or is it just me time and whatever you feel like that day? Or do you get up and do some type of exercise, meditation, reading? Like what does it look like for you?
I had originally started with a couple different things that I was doing, including writing and working out and trying to, you know, read a couple blogs and all of this. And I realized that that was starting to kind of stress me out because all of a sudden I had all these things that I wanted to do. So just within the past couple of weeks, I have just said, you know what, this is me time. And really what I want to be doing is blogging. And so I'm waking up in the morning and I sit down at my computer and I get at least 30 minutes to an hour where I can just sit down and write. And I love it.
That is so cool. Really. I mean, I think waking up early is something I've always aspired to. And just like you, I have that love-hate kind of relationship with the idea. And the love part is not yet winning out. but I still aspire. There's still room for improvement here. And maybe this is the little kick that I needed to pull it off. Mr. Wow, what about you? Your favorite life hack?
So mine is biking. I guess more appropriately, like two-wheeled vehicles. I have a motorcycle and a bicycle, and I try to ride my bicycle to work every day. And when I don't do that and I need to get somewhere quickly, especially in Los Angeles because of the traffic, I take the motorcycle. But with the biking to work, it's 45 minutes. I bike 12 miles each way every day. And it's about 45 minutes of cardio in and 45 minutes of cardio back. And it just levels me and makes me feel better, you know, out in the air. And I'm not dealing with traffic and I'm not dealing with everything. So, yeah, that's a huge one.
How long have you been doing the bicycling for?
Oh, man, 7 years. I used to ride 17 miles each way. Then I changed jobs and we moved and I rode 3 miles each way. And then I just got a new job and now I'm going 12 miles each way again. So I've been doing that, yeah, for quite a while.
Mustachios represent.
Yeah, this was before we even found out about any of that. We just happened to live right near a bike path that shot me straight into the office and it was right on the beach. So I was like, yeah, I can't pass this up.
All right, Mr. Wow, question number four, your biggest financial mistake.
This one I tossed around and thought about quite a bit, and there's benefits to it, so I don't know if it's necessarily a mistake, but going to grad school and getting my MBA could potentially be a huge mistake. It cost me quite a bit of money, and I'm still actually have loans 10 years later that I'm paying off, and I think my career had some advancement, but I'd be willing to bet if I didn't have the MBA, I'd probably be in a similar spot. On the flip side, it moved me to California and I met my wife and I have a whole new life. So that's why I'm kind of torn on if it's a mistake. But financially, I don't know. I mean, I've been paying off a student loan for almost 12 years now.
Financial mistake, not a life mistake.
There you go. That's why it's qualified that way.
All right. And Mrs. Wow, what about you? Your biggest financial mistake?
This is one that I don't even think I've wrote about this yet.
Breaking news.
This is before Mr. Wow and I started dating, before the FI mindset, before all of that. I didn't have a lot, but I definitely had a balance on my credit card. I thought that I was doing just enough by paying the minimum payment every month and did that longer than I really should have. And I realize the implications that it has now.
Wow. So at the time, what were you thinking? Like, and I don't mean that like negatively. I just mean, what was going through it? Was it just, oh, they're telling me to pay the minimum, so that's what I pay? Or like, did you not realize the interest rate? Talk me through that real quick.
Yeah. Like I mentioned before, I never really was a numbers person. And so to answer your question, I don't think I really was thinking. It was, I mean, I could have paid it off, but I didn't understand why I would do that. You know, why spend $1,000 when I could spend
25,
30. Yeah.
You know, I want to slow down because I know that like in this very focus group, people are like, oh wow, that's crazy. You always pay it off. But I don't think that actually is the normal perception. I think that's why when we talk about people having trouble with credit cards, I think it's for that exact reason. Why would I pay $500 toward my credit card when I could just pay 25? It's just the obvious choice. I'm just being smart with my numbers. If I only send them 25, then I'm going to have 475 for this month. I genuinely think that represents the majority of the world's view on how credit card payments should happen. Well, the minimum payment is affordable. That's fine. We'll just work with it.
Yeah, I think that's with debt in general, right? I think that's part of the reason why people get in a lot of trouble.
Okay, question number five, Mrs. Wow, advice you would give your younger self. It can be, don't settle for the minimum, but if you have something else you want to pass along to in that time capsule, this is your chance.
Yeah, you know what? I think this actually ties right into what you just said, is don't be afraid to go against the norm. And really, if you're passionate about something, just go do it. If everybody's doing it one way and you know you think you're supposed to do it this way, that doesn't mean that's the only way. And that's not doesn't mean that that's the right way to do it. So really not being afraid to take a chance, take a risk, and really see, you know, how that can impact your life for the better.
Yeah, that's really wonderful, wonderful advice. I love that. And Mr. Rouse, same question for you. The advice you would give your younger self.
For me, I think it's it kind of goes along the same lines, but it's just go get started, right? Like so many people sit there and hum and haw over what they should do and if this is the right decision and if it's not and things of that nature. But if you're confident in what you're doing, just go get started. And a lot of you'll figure it out along the way. That's kind of how I ended up, I mean, administering a 401k, right? So I had no idea about any of it. So I just picked up the phone and made a phone call and started going and started filling out paperwork. You know, and we figure it out as we go. Do we make mistakes? Yeah. But, you know, if you don't get started, you never get anywhere, right? It's always that first step. And so that's for me. I mean, I would tell myself that a long time because I used to hesitate a lot on a lot of things.
Well, we do have a bonus question for you. We spent a lot of time talking about things that you don't purchase in the name of frugality. This question directed at you, Mr. Wow, your favorite purchase that you made over the last 12 months, the purchase that you made that has brought the most value to your life.
So I bought a bookshelf beer making kit that allows us to brew beer at a gallon at a time to try and figure it out because we like to drink probably more beer than we should. And so we figured we'd try and figure out what the process was that went into it. And it's a lot more complicated than they tend to let you believe. But that one brings us a lot of joy because we get to spend all day Saturday boiling stuff and bottling things and I don't know. It's kind of a weird one, but there you go.
I think you have some good company with this craft beer situation. I know Physician on Fire is an investor in one and Mr. 1500, a copious fan as well. So you're in good company.
Oh yeah. For whatever reason, Phi and craft beer go hand in hand. I don't know what it is. And we actually have our Phi meetups monthly at the local breweries.
Very, very nice.
Mrs. Wow, same question. The purchase that you made in the last 12 months that's added the most value to your life?
Going back to all the travel that we've been talking about, one of the things that I get a lot of value out of is purchasing a Lonely Planet book to the country or the city that we are going to. And I find it useful just to kind of give me some, be able to research where we're going, read about the history, read about the culture. But you never know when you might need a map. Or you might need some key phrases in the language. And, you know, of course, everyone's like, oh, but you have your phone, you'll have Wi-Fi. Sometimes you might not, or it might not be working. And there have been so many times that we've been out and I can open up the book and, you know, I can try to either say what I'm trying to say or I can point at a picture in the map. And that thing just brings so much value. But I will throw in that I try to bring out a little bit of frugality with that. And I always wait for discounts. And they usually do like a 2 or a 3 for 1. So I'll always wait and then buy the books at that point.
And then the 2 or 3 for 1 dictates the next country that you need to go to.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, usually I already have it kind of lined up.
You already have the Nepal book, don't you?
I do. I'm guilty. But a few of them I'll just throw in like, I really want this one. So if I buy it, maybe it will come to fruition.
This has been so much fun. What is the best way for someone to connect with you?
So we're on Twitter at Waffles on Wed. And we have our blog. It's wafflesonwednesday.com.
Guys, thank you so much for coming on the show today.
Thank you, guys. It's been a real pleasure.
This has been fantastic. Thank you.
You know, Brad, as with everything, I think it's balance, right? But in my mind, I love that this episode, it told an amazing story, but at the same time, it was so actionable and so useful. And I think there will be a large percentage of our population that is side hustlers and entrepreneurs or aspiring entrepreneurs that have been waiting for us to have someone on the show that could do this and point them in the right direction. This was that episode in my mind.
Yeah, I agree. It had a little bit of everything. We certainly dove into the numbers, dove into the details, but we also looked at their lives and where Phi has taken them and where it's going to take them in the future with their travels and now with this incredible entrepreneurial story that they have going. So yeah, really wonderful episode and just wanted to thank the Wows for coming on and spending the time with us.
If you got value from today's episode, if you've been getting value from the episodes up to this point, just take 1 second and press the subscribe button on the platform you're listening to this on. It just lets the providers know you're getting value from the show and you want to be here when we produce additional content. If you want to support us and what we're doing here at Choose FI, here are 4 easy ways. 1, leave us an iTunes review. If you want to do that, just go to chooseify.com/iTunes. 2, use our page to sign up for travel credit cards. If you want to travel the world with miles and points instead of your hard-earned dollars, then just go to chooseify.com/cards and get started today. 3, if you're working on the milestones of FI, set up a personal capital account to track your progress and use our affiliate link. It's completely free and just go to choosefi.com/PC. P as in Paul, C as in cat. And 4, and most importantly, find your friends, coworkers, and family members who might be open to this message and tell them about the podcast. Have them start with episode 38, The Why of FI, and right behind that, have them go listen to episode 21, The Pillars of FI. It is a fantastic starting place. All right, my friends, the fire is spreading. We'll see you next time as we continue to go down the road less traveled.
You've been listening to Choose FI Radio Podcast, where we help middle-class America build wealth, one life hack at a time.